Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And Dr. Gwyther, Bob is filling in for Christy during this segment today, and it's good to have you back again, Bob.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You know, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Reed Wilson, Director of the Anxiety Disorders Treatment Center and an international expert about hoarding in your health. I'm really interested in hearing what he has to say.
I've seen a couple of patients whose houses were virtually impassable because of that problem.
Yeah, and hoarding can occur around all kinds of things like newspapers or cats or I'm sure many, many things that we don't normally think about.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
But first, though, we do have some research that matters that hopefully will not be all sad, but we're going to be talking about a televised medicine talk shows. Is it health education or is it entertainment? We're going to be talking about kids and energy drinks and the relationship to hyperactivity and inattention, about unemployment and suicide, and about women, veterans, and cardiac heart catheterizations. What's our very first research that matters, Bob?
So this is a study that was published in the British Medical Journal comparing a couple of popular doctor shows, the Dr. Oz show and one other one called The Doctors, to see if they gave anything that was a benefit to anybody. Was it specific? And what was the magnitude of the benefit? Did they mention cost and did they mention conflict of interest?
Yeah, so this is like near and dear to both Christy and I and Bob and I because, you know, we're in the business of giving information, or so we think, and information that we hope, like research that matters, that's useful. And the question is, are some of these other healthcare providers, Dr. Oz shows, are they giving this similar information or is it different? And then how would it compare, let's say, to the type of information that we may give? And in this particular study, they researchers actually looked at shows that were aired from January to April 2013, 40 episodes of each show. Two people independently ranked them and they rewatched them and then saw whether or not they answered the questions that, Bob, you just mentioned. What did they find?
Well, one of the things they found is about a third of the recommendations from the Dr. Oz show had believable evidence.
Which means two-thirds did not.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
And about half of the recommendation on the doctors has believable evidence.
So again, half of it does not, which is a big problem.
Right. They found that the Oz show gave dietary advice about 40% of the time, and the doctor's show about 16 or 17.
Did only mention harms less than 10% of the time, potential harms of a treatment, and talking about the cost of a treatment about 12%, and in the doctor's only 3%. And then I guess one other last thing was they looked at 924 total recommendations, and only four times were there potential conflicts of interest mentioned that perhaps – the products that are being mentioned or perhaps being advertised on the show, something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, entertainment, it must be, or they wouldn't keep getting ratings and keep renewing them. Actual health information, you probably need a source that's going to be a little more reliable.
And just for our listeners, for interest's sake, Christy and I have actually had independent researchers from the School of Public Health, University of North Carolina, look at the show and the information that we give in efforts that we can improve. Are we using the type of language that's understandable? Are the recommendations that we give evidence-based? Are we talking about all these other issues? And we will strive. Our commitment is to strive to continue to provide that type of information. You'll hold us accountable as listeners if we're not.
Right.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, Bob.
So this is one on kids and energy drinks. And Yale University researchers looked at 1,600 kids in middle schools, average age around 12. And boys were more likely to consume these than girls. They published their article in Academic Pediatrics. I mean, the question here is, what happens when kids take a powerful drink that has a lot of caffeine and a lot of sugar in it? And if they get wired, would that surprise you?
It wouldn't surprise me in the least. But, you know, it's kind of interesting because I don't drink energy drinks. Do you drink these at all?
I drink coffee for sure, but right. I don't drink energy
drinks. You don't have an energy drink that has 30 grams of sugar and you know, has the equivalent of 6 cups of coffee in one drink.
And the other thing that I think is worth saying here is that they did find that kids with ADD, hyperactivity disorder, seemed to drink more of this stuff. But then since that's the category of therapeutic drugs for people with that problem, then maybe that makes sense.
Right. We hard to know what's cause and what's effect here. But they were 66% more likely, the kids who were consuming these energy drinks, to be at risk for hyperactivity. I think this is one of those things that we need to start asking about as providers in the exam room, and we need to counsel parents. It's pretty straightforward. There's a very little benefit and potential risk.
And I agree with the Academy of Pediatrics that we shouldn't be feeding our kids these high-energy drinks.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, which I found really fascinating, Bob. This linkage between unemployment and perhaps an association with 1/5 of suicides around the world. Wow.
Yeah, the Swiss actually collected data from 63 different countries in 4 different regions of the world and found a 20 to 30% increased risk of suicide for people who are unemployed.
You know, this is suicides account for 233,000 deaths a year, and being jobless was associated with about 1/5 or 45,000 of these suicides. This was published in The Lancet Psychiatry, an international respected journal.
And they found that both women and men of equal ages were equally vulnerable to this problem, and that perhaps countries where there was a stronger work responsibility or ethic were more problematic than those where it wasn't the case.
Take-home message for me here, Bob, is that if you know of someone, or we as a provider come across a patient, loved one, that has lost a job recently, it's not just about finding a new job, it's also supporting them emotionally and that they are at higher risk for suicide.
And we need to realize that the unemployment figures we look for aren't just woeful for the economy and the stock market, it's also for people's real lives.
Bingo, thank you. A last research that matters has to do about women veterans and the association between heart disease. And this was in the American Heart Association Journal. Real quickly, what did they find?
Well, they had a look at people who had cardiac catheterizations. And if you look at the ordinary population, women that have cardiac catheter done were more likely to have diseases such as hypertension, diabetes, and cholesterol than men. But if you look at women veterans, they were less likely to have these antecedent factors.
And the women veterans had higher rates of depression, higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder than the male veterans, indicating that mental health is perhaps the risk factor for these women to be having these heart catheterizations. I think this is a really important, as we have more and more women health veterans. We had the director of the VA Medical Center in Durham on our show recently. This is important. I'm sure we'll be talking about it more late
right.
and soon.
And especially the women who are in combat situations and other very stressful things as or activities as opposed to being back in the country.
And we'll be able to actually hear from our guest today, Dr. Reed Wilson, about anxiety. And I'm sure he'll have a lot to say about the anxiety and stress and maybe even heart disease. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Reed Wilson, director of the Anxiety Disorders Treatment Center, an international expert, about hoarding and your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh, resident physician and guest co-host filling in today for Adam. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we'll be talking with Dr. Reed Wilson, director of the Anxiety Disorders Treatment Center in North Carolina and international expert about hoarding and your health.
Welcome, Dr. Wilson. Thank you so much for joining us today. You've written a couple of books, Don't Panic and Stop Obsessing. Wondering if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about how you got into psychiatry and specifically about compulsive disorders.
Sure. Well, I decided to get into psychology, actually not psychiatry, to keep track of my own mental health. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a smart thing to do. It was going to take all my life. So I really started in the field of self-help. And so I worked in self-help and sexuality in my college years and then worked in chronic pain. And then back in the 70s, I do have gray hair, the media did a great deal of exposure on agoraphobia, right, the severe panic attacks. And people just came in through the woodwork to see us. And I had this affinity for that area and had learned skills of relaxation and so forth. And that started my work around anxiety disorders. Mm-hmm. I worked with Dr. Edna Foa, who's really a star in this field and created the primary treatment of OCD. And so we wrote a book together called Stop Obsessing. So that's how I kind of branched out. Now, basically, work with any anxiety disorder that shows up.
As we're talking about hoarding in your health today, help us understand what exactly is a hoarder and how does that relate with the anxiety and compulsion disorders?
Sure. Well, hoarding has been under this umbrella of obsessive compulsive disorder. And as the two of you know, that has changed a little bit. It is standalone. So someone who is a hoarder has issues around acquiring things, picking up things, carrying things home, mm-hmm. and having difficulty discarding things. And then the third trait is this clutter. So you'll have a number of people who order things off QVC, and it's interesting because it is the thrill of the hunt for many of them. I worked with a family, actually two grown daughters and their mother, all three hoarders, all three living together. Father, who was deceased, was also a hoarder. Mm-hmm. But when I walked in their dining room, it was full of boxes that they had ordered and never opened. Mm-hmm. The closets full of clothes, never taken the tags off. So there's an interesting thing about acquiring that goes on, and then the inability to discard. We can talk more about those details as we go along, but those two things. And then it gets dangerous over time because you can't walk through the halls. You've got children at home that things can fall on them and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's a serious problem. I'll say one last thing about that, which is they don't see it as that. And that is the biggest trouble. This is a very difficult disorder to begin to make changes in.
So is that how you set it apart from just being a collector, collecting toy cars and trucks? Some people enjoy the hunt of that as well.
Or people say, oh, I'm a pack rat because I keep stuff from college, or my attic is full of random stuff that I haven't thrown away. What tips people over to being a hoarder versus being sort of a collector or like a pack rat?
Sure. Well, if you talk to a hoarder, they will describe themselves that way too because they don't have a perception of what's going on. When we look at hoarders, we find that – and so I can treat you later, Christy, if people aren't seeing your face right now with the bulging eyes. And I don't – now I don't know the question. How do you distinguish two? Well, one is the danger that goes on. They're acquiring too much. Mm-hmm. They're spending too much money. Their house is a chaotic mess. Their family is embarrassed. Their growing children don't want to bring anybody over. Their spouse doesn't want to bring anybody over. Mm-hmm. They've lost perspective on everything. If they've really – so the older they get – the more severe the disorder. Hmm. So it starts showing up very often, little signs of it, about 18 or so, although I've worked with kids as young as 6 and 7. About 7 or 8 years later, it becomes moderate. About 35, it's strong. About 55, it is its worst. And that's very often when families start making contact with us because things have just fallen apart and they are – or they are being forced to make a change, which is in many ways the only way some of them will do anything about this.
So it sounds like it's often someone from the outside of the family, who's taken notice and gives a signal that there should be some help sought.
Sure, and we primarily work with the families because mm-hmm. they're the ones that are seeking change, and they're the ones that are concerned about their loved ones, very mm-hmm. often their mother or their father, but it's twice as likely to be a dad than a mother. Mm-hmm. Men are much more likely to have that trouble. But again, you were asking the distinction, and there's genetic distinctions too. We've got family. So you, Chris, do you have a relative that's a hoarding as well? Or, I know you're not a hoarder, mm-hmm. but you're going to very often have a first-degree relative, somebody in the family, like I was mentioned before, those kids and their mom. And we are finding some changes in certain areas of the brain, which I won't go into because I don't have the capacity to go into that, that distinguish hoarders from people with OCD even.
Okay.
So,
and then what – so there might be a genetic – like people might be more predisposed.
They're absolutely predisposed.
So there's a genetic part, maybe a cultural part if they've been raised with someone who does this.
Some modeling.
Okay.
So we also would see some trauma.
Okay, that's what I was going to get at. What else?
Now, if you've got people with animal hoarding, you're more likely to see some struggles in childhood, possibly some abuse, possibly some trauma there.
Animal hoarding meaning the person who has 100 cats?
Yeah, like that. But again, it's most of those who are doing hoarding of animals are like the other hoarders, which is they don't take care of anything. Hmm. Everything – so the animals end up getting – they get called in, the police come in, and it's a tough place mm-hmm. for animal hoarding, and we may not want to take much time around that particular thing, but that's a pretty tough one. But they just don't understand, and so things will start to fall apart. It's interesting, some of their traits, because they don't know how to organize anything. They will organize by nothing, really. They find an object, and a couple things happen. Well, they find an object, and if they suddenly think of a way they might use it, they now must take it. So if they see a pamphlet, they'll take four pamphlets because they'll instantly have three other people that they could give it to. So they go to buy toilet paper and they'll fill in a whole closet full of toilet paper because, hey, you never know.
You might need it.
So mm-hmm. that is just something happens in the mind. There's something wrong, obviously. Anybody with a mental health disorder, something's gone askew, and this is one of them, right? So mm-hmm. And the other thing, they will come in since they don't know how to organize. They're confused. There's indecision. They'll say, "I'm just going to set it down here, mm-hmm. and deal with it later," and that's how you start getting the piles.
Wow. Well, I know you've been involved as a psychologist and consultant for the show, the A&E's Hoarders mm-hmm. show, and we'll mm-hmm. be interested in hearing about. I mean, that's really how many of us know or have a little bit of insight to this from that show. We'll be interested in hearing your perspective and experience about that and learning more about misconceptions and most importantly, about treatment and the future. But we do need to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Reed Wilson, director of the Anxiety Disorders Treatment Center in North Carolina, about hoarding and your health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh, resident physician and guest host filling in for Adam today. We've been talking with Dr. Reed Wilson, director of the Anxiety Disorders Treatment Center in North Carolina, about hoarding and your health. And Dr. Wilson, you were teaching us a little bit about the definition of hoarders and describing what hoarders do by acquiring more things and having trouble discarding things and having clutter to the point of danger in their homes. And you've even, you've written some books, but you've also been involved in the show Hoarders. And wondered if you'd share a little bit, how'd you become involved in that show and what was that like for you?
Yeah, I only did one episode, and I'm sure somebody dropped out at the last minute and they brought me in. So it's an interesting show if you have seen it. Some of my colleagues don't like those kinds of shows. They think they take advantage of people with mental health. But this family, I would guess, received $50,000 worth of services by that show, with, you know, people coming in and hauling 12 trucks worth of things out of their house and so forth. So there's a lot going on. And they also set aside money for follow-up treatment. And so all that was interesting. But you walk in there and they hoard cats as well. They had locked all those away at the vets for that. But there was feces all over the carpets and the floors. And these three women walked barefoot through there. Wow. There's a kind of obliviousness to that experience. They collected Beanie Babies, and they had 2,500 Beanie Babies. But you could pick up one of the women I was working with. You couldn't even find how she got in her bed because it was so cluttered. But if you picked up an item that was there, they could tell you very often where that came from. What were they doing that day? So items acquire emotional attachment very rapidly with them. And that's part of what tends to happen when they get stuck. It was a long row to hoe.
Yeah.
And certainly the follow through with the organizer was, you know, they had a certain amount of money set aside. I said, I don't think you should spend it on a psychologist. I think you should spend it on an organizer. That's your best money.
You're an expert in this field. Were you prepared for that experience, walking in through that house and seeing what you saw?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. I've been around the block. I've been doing this 30 years, so I've seen a lot of things. But everybody wore a face mask except I was the only one who didn't wear a face mask. I'm on TV. I'm not going to put a face mask on. Come on. So
How exactly did they hire you, or they ask you to come and or to reveal a family you're already engaged with, or they identify the family and they invite you to come in as an expert to then see the situation and make recommendations?
Right. They bring us in. They bring one psychologist in. They bring an organizer in, and we work with them for a day, and then the trucks come. And then we work with them for the next 2 days to do 3 days worth of intense, long days of intense work with them. And you have to be very clear about what you're going to do. You're going to take one room at a time. You're going to take one corner at a time. You're going to work with the bigger items that can be moved quickly. If they touch an item, it must be placed somewhere else. You've got three choices. You can throw it away or recycle it or keep it. If you're going to keep it, you got to know where it goes. So all of that has to be set up with any hoarder that you work with, because otherwise it's just chaos. They have an inability to bring order to anything. So
what is really the treatment plan? So there's the safety elements and organization elements of clearing out stuff and deciding what's going to go and stay and where it's going to go and those sorts of things. But the underlying tendency is still there, of course. So how does this go from, you see in the show, the trucks come in and then it looks a little bit better. Then what happens? How do people actually get better?
I mean, let's back up a minute about how in the world do you do it. You've got to get them on board in a change process. They have to have something that they want. Now, it may be simply I want to keep my house and it's being condemned, or I want to keep my marriage, or I want my life back, perhaps. But you need some kind of motivation outside of that. And then they have to start to understand this, at least in how I work with them, this is not about these items. This is not about that. So if we can dissociate from I collect things because they're important to me and move it back to I have this inability to sort. I have the – you know, these are my problem areas. And then we train them about decision making. We get something going around organizing. We bring – as I said, we bring the family members in just as quickly as we can because you can't clock a whole lot of hours as a health professional in someone's home. It's just not cost effective for them. So we want to train the family members, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody throws anything out except for the patient. Mm. Nobody. Nobody gets to do anything without permission. You know, it's like
control.
I had a client whose husband and pilot friend tricked her into a stationary plane and then took off. And she had a fear of flying. I mean, and that's like this too. You don't throw anything out. People will go, quote unquote, insane if you do something like that to them. So that's not to do.
What goes into maintenance after you've done this intensive couple of days treatment with someone? Obviously, getting the family involved and having them help the patient further on, but. This started when they were 18 and now they're 55. That's a long history of this disorder. How do you maintain it beyond that?
No, well, a great deal of the maintenance needs to be what we're talking about right now. That's why I was saying somebody like an organizer who knows what's going on. There are organizers there, you know, for chaotic clutter. And so that is helpful. The psychotherapy stuff is useful too. Anecdotally, what you see is that they do actually have a loss prior to the big hoarding experiences. And so sometimes that kind of working through is helpful, but there's no, you know, stalling on going in there and starting to get work. So family members, if we can train them that they can bring a box to the patient to start working on, or they can help them put a box together to bring into therapy, we'll have them bring boxes of things directly into the office and work on them, go through all of that. But you don't do it by taking out a little girl's dress and going, okay, well, let's decide now. Do you remember how you acquired this? You never ask that question because they'll say, oh, that was when my daughter was so-and-so.
Right.
And then you go, well, do you want to discard this or recycle this or throw it away or keep it? Oh, well, I'll keep it. You don't ask questions regarding a specific item like that if you want to get the work done. So it and so again, what you're saying, Catherine, asking about the maintenance, it's easy for them to slip back in unless the work gets done around it's my mind tells me it's this, but it's really about that. I'm working with somebody now and she says this, you know, getting online at nighttime with QVC is the only thing that brings me happiness. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not true. That's not true. It's the only thing that gets her away from anxiety. That's not about happiness. It's about if I don't go do this right now. So this is what happens to somebody with the smoking habit. You know, they go, oh, I just like the taste. Oh, is that true? Give me your pack of cigarettes and let me hold it for 24 hours and we'll see why you grab a cigarette. So, but if we can make that change, which is – I understand this pattern that I've been doing is about something bigger, and I know how to handle that. Now we begin to turn the reins back over to them. That's all we want to do forever. That's what the family wants to do too.
You mentioned earlier the relationship with compulsive disorders and changes in the brain with people who have a problem with hoarding. Are there medication treatments that are helpful in general for hoarders, or what are the opportunities there for research?
As you know, for most of the anxiety disorders, the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, are used.
Zoloft and Celexa.
Right, and they're very common for OCD. They don't tend to work very well with hoarders. And I think there's some chemical issues going on, but I also think this is much more like a personality disorder. Mm. This is not something like OCD. I'm doing this. I don't want to do this, but I feel compelled to do this. That's not what they're saying. I'm doing this. What's wrong with this? Everybody collects things. Even my doctor, Christy, collects things. So this is fine.
So what we need to wrap up. This is just a bookmark in a much longer conversation. But what message would you give to people out there who are listening to this and either thinking, huh, that rings true for my family member, or, huh, I collect things. How do I know if I've passed into that and I don't know? What do you recommend for listeners who this might sort of raise some questions for?
Well, my guess would be the listeners it'll raise questions for are the family members. And I would say instead of going, you know, oh, that sounds really good. I need to get my mom in or my dad in for some help. I would say to you is I need to come in and get a consultation with somebody to start figuring out what to do with my mom and my dad, because the likelihood of getting mom or dad to walk into a therapist's office and say, please help me with my problem, is very, very small. So let's start in steps by gathering some people together who care about this person and figure out together what to do next.
And is there a website or a place that you reference people to go for the most important information?
Sure. I think the International Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Foundation has a very nice section all on hoarding, and that's good. So it's IOCDF.
We'll link it on our blog.
Good. Sure. I'll give it to you.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for taking time with us today and sharing your expertise about hoarding. It's been very revealing.
You're welcome.
We've been talking with Dr. Reed Wilson, director of the Anxiety Disorders Treatment Center in North Carolina, about hoarding and your health. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Coe.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. Bob, that was a really fascinating interview about hoarding. I think there are a lot of important information.
And it's more common than we might think.
Well, we're going to transition to the House Call segment of our show today, and we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have questions you'd like for us to answer on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like our executive producer, Erica Nouri, to tell us or to ask the first House Call question.
My 30-year-old granddaughter has smoked for years, to my great concern. Now she has switched to electronic cigarettes. Are electronic cigarettes safer? I also find it alarming to hear advertising on the radio for these things. I know that after the U.S. Surgeon General issued his findings and warnings years ago, all advertising for tobacco products were banned. What is the situation today with advertising electronic cigarettes?
Oh, this is such a great question and such an important question, and I can't tell you how many people I hear from, Bob, on a daily basis who say, how do we continue to allow these products to be advertised when we really don't know much about their safety?
And the answer is it's worth a lot of money to some people.
But the problem is that you're absolutely correct that advertising of most, really all of these tobacco products are off TV. But e-cigarettes have come on the scene so quickly that the laws and the regulations haven't caught up. And it will happen. The Food and Drug Administration is looking at new regulations to limit the safety and the claims on outcomes, because we don't know long-term safety data. We don't know the outcomes. There are concerns. And it's safer than what? Safer than continuing to smoke cigarettes and use electronic cigarettes. Safer than an adolescent who never has used an e-cigarette. It may offer some benefit for someone who was doing smoke 4 packs a day and went down to electronic cigarettes and then quit. That's the ideal. But a lot of people don't do that. So for the advertising right now, as a consumer, you just have to speak up, speak out, speak loudly.
Right. And I got to tell you that I want to stand 10 feet back from this question and say, why would anyone want to get addicted to anything that was going to be as a little benefit to them as nicotine?
Yep. So we encourage you, if you find something you don't like, use your voice. That's what it's there for. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I'm a woman in my late 50s, and I've been on hormonal replacement therapy drugs for about 7 years. My friends say that I should stop taking them, but my doctor seems adamant about keeping me on them. How long is it safe for me to stay on these?
Good question.
We did an awful lot of prescription under the guise that we were saving people's bones and improving their hearts for decades. And then out came the Nurses' Health Study and disproved the cardiac benefit. And we realized that saving bone, A, probably doesn't last much longer than 5 or 6 years, and B, there's other ways you can do that. And so the question is, are you willing to run the negative cardiovascular effects and negative effects on breast cancer and this sort of thing in order to get whatever benefit you're getting out of this?
Right. I like to say, I like to get people off medications whenever we can. And so if you've been on them for 7 years, you probably have gone through the menopausal time period. And let's give you a chance to see if you do well off of it in terms of symptoms, which is probably the reason you went on them. Let's look individually what your osteoporosis risk factors are. But as you said, Bob, the benefits are probably already been received. So there may be risks that may accumulate to you. The benefits may be uncertain. Worth a try to talk with your doctor about getting off of them, I think. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My teenage son has been acting out lately. My wife and I have caught him skipping school and noticed a recent change in friends. We, of course, have disciplined him for cutting class, but we wonder if there is something deeper underlying problem. Every time we ask him about what's going on, he clams up. I'm not sure if taking him to see a specialist would help. Would we even get answers due to patient-doctor confidentiality?
Well, first off, thank you so much for writing to us with this question. This is an important issue and a sensitive issue and one that's not easy to talk about. You know, first off, your son may be reticent to talk with you. You may have a hard time talking with your friends, and you're reticent even perhaps to bring it up with the doctor because of patient-doctor confidentiality, which creates a situation that no one's talking. We've got to reverse that.
Right. So, teenagers are hard to discuss things with, and that's common. It's a normative thing. On the other hand, you've got some data here that he's been cutting school, and you've caught that and tried to deal with it, that he's got a new set of friends. And I think those things raise important questions, not
red
the
flags.
Least of which could be substance abuse of some sort or other. So I think that it's important to have the conversation, and if you can't have it with him, perhaps you can get some neutral person, psychologist, family doc, pediatrician to help with that.
Drug testing, is that something you would do or not?
Well, I probably would talk to the kid about it and maybe want to get that done.
Because there's so many red flags here, and I agree with you, Bob. I would insist, actually, that you go in and see your primary care provider. I would insist that perhaps see someone. Trust your instincts. Your instincts are on target here, and that's one of the few things you probably can fully trust.
And understand that provider is obliged to keep confidentiality, even with a teenager, around certain things to do with substance abuse, sexual behaviors, unless they're going to be dangerous to themselves.
That's correct. So thank you for that question. Erica, what's our very last house call?
I'm 30 years old and am pregnant with my first child, and I've had a cold that's been lingering for about a week. What advice do you have for me in terms of home remedies I could try that's safe for my baby?
Well, the good news, Bob, here before you answer, is it's been going on for about a week.
So it's probably going to go away no matter what you do in a couple of days because it's probably a viral syndrome. I think you have to pay special attention when you have a baby in a uterus that's inside of you. And you probably can use some little Tylenol if that's really necessary and that's safe with your baby. But other things I'd have a conversation with my physician about. On the other hand, you can certainly go down to the drugstore, buy yourself some nasal saline sprays, a neti pot or whatever. You can take a nice hot shower, deep breathe, get this stuff liquefied and blow it out of your body mechanically. You don't need a drug to dry it up necessarily.
Love green tea. Big fan of tea and honey and lemon, things and that symptomatically can make you feel better.
Chicken soup, absolutely. Don't disregard that.
And maybe it's matzo ball soup.
Yeah.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls. We've had a good chance to talk about, maybe just waiting out the cold and sometimes about teenagers and acting out and seeing your doctor.
And sometimes about being pregnant and having a cold and feeling frustrated because you're not supposed to take anything for it.
And finally, about e-cigarettes and advice really to maybe speak out against the advertising if you don't really like it, which we don't either. That'll conclude the section of House Calls, and we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can write us and email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us at Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Reed Wilson, and my guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We hope you'll join us again next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Bob Gwyther.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.